Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The administration's green agenda is a big turnaround from the Bush years. President Obama's team is calling for action on climate change and a clean, green approach to energy by the end of this year. Congress takes its first real look at capping carbon emissions this week, but strong headwinds are brewing on all sides. This hour, On Point, taking stock of this environmental moment. You can join the conversation. What's your hope for the green agenda? Do you agree with the big focus on climate change? We've got some top environmental thinkers with us today. Later this hour, we'll hear from author Bill McKibben and Congressman Ed Markey, whose new energy and climate change bill is in hearings this week. But first, we're joined from Washington by Juliet Eilprin. She's national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Juliet, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And from Williamstown, Massachusetts, we're joined by Elizabeth Culbert. She's staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Betsy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hearings today, beginning on this so-called American Clean Energy and Security Act. Juliet, set the table for us. What are the big points in this bill?
Well, the most significant point is that this is the House leadership-backed bill that would establish for the first time ever mandatory limits in the United States on greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide, but also other contributors to climate change. So that's one of the most important things it would do. It also has provisions in there that would set a renewable portfolio standard for the nation in order towards requiring utilities to derive a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources and would push for energy efficiency. It also leaves some of the key questions at this moment unanswered in terms of how basically both exactly how much money the government will raise in terms of pollution credits and how it would spend that money.
Let's listen before we go on to a piece this week from ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Here's White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel talking about an energy bill, talking about the fact that President Obama will have an energy bill by the end of this congressional season.
At the end of this first year of Congress, there will be an energy bill on the president's desk.
It includes cap and trade?
Our goal is to get that done. We will see. You're asking me right before the legislative process starts to make that prediction. I do think this, that even those who object to particulars know that we have to deal with this part of our energy policy.
So, Betsy Culbert, talk about that part of this bill, this policy. At the center of this plan is this complicated cap and trade system. First of all, explain very simply, what is cap and trade?
Well, very simply, what happens with a cap and trade system is you set a cap, as the title indicates, and then you have to this is where things get very, very complicated. You set an overall cap, but then you have to apportion out what you might call credits. So in the case of carbon dioxide, major emitters would get allowances. Let's call them allowances. So I'm a coal-fired power plant. I'm a big utility company. I would get my allowance, or I would have to buy my allowance. As Juliet said, these are huge unanswered questions at this point, you know, exactly how that would work. And then if I came in under my allowance, I would accrue credits, which I could sell on a carbon market. Mm-hmm. The anticipation is there'd be then a trading market. And if I came in over, so I didn't come in under my cap, I needed to buy allowances, I would go to that same market and buy them. And the idea is that over time, this cap would come down, so the cap would get lower and lower, my allowances would get lower and lower, and this would spur savings. And I'd have to figure out ways to either generate power or do whatever I'm doing, emitting less greenhouse gases, or it would get more and more expensive
so,
for me.
So bringing this back to the consumer then, in essence, the utility that feeds power to my house has to buy a permit. Does that mean it's going to raise my taxes and pass along the cost of this to me? Is that what is in this bill?
Well, it's not going to raise your taxes. It's going to raise your energy costs.
My rates. Yeah.
Yes. If it doesn't do that, and this is where the whole thing becomes kind of a word game, to be honest. And in a pure sense, I do want to say, if you're just an economist, you're designing this as a pure system with no, you know, sort of chicanery, a cap and trade should be equivalent to a carbon tax. That's the whole point. And the reason for doing a carbon tax, as you know, just about anybody, a carbon cap and trade, as opposed to a tax, which is much easier to administer, a much cleaner system, a much more efficient economic system, is to avoid the word tax. But at the end of the day, if they are not raising the price of carbon-based energy, then the whole thing is sort of just a joke.
Here's another piece of sound, again, from Sunday. Republican Minority Leader John Boehner talking about the cap-and-trade carbon emissions, and he raises objections to the Democrats' proposal to cap-and-trade carbon emissions to combat climate change.
We don't want to raise taxes, $1.5 to $2 trillion, like the administration is proposing, and we don't want to ship millions of American jobs overseas. And so we've got to find ways to work toward this solution to this problem without risking the future for our kids and grandkids.
Juliet, this is such a key component of this bill. Is it fair to call this cap and trade a tax? And is it the best way to go?
Well, there are two parts to that question. So in terms of, is it fair to call it a tax? I mean, I think Betsy makes an excellent point, which is, certainly it's in some extent it is, because it's forcing people to pay more for fossil fuel derived energy. However, when you receive all this money, you have lots of ways to spend it out. And one of the things that's been gaining some political currency on Capitol Hill is the idea of a dividend, essentially returning money directly to consumers in some form that would offset some of the pain that they'll incur by higher energy prices, and, you know, which again, they can spend it on whatever they want, but it will help make them whole to some extent. So, you know, when John Boehner and the Republicans, who have gone hard on this issue and talked about the idea of an energy tax, which is a line they think will resonate with voters and may resonate with voters, it's not entirely fair to certainly put dollar figures associated with how much more people will be paying when you're not looking at what's going to happen with the federal revenue that would be generated from a cap-and-trade system. And then in terms of whether it's the best way to go, I mean, there are a couple different arguments on this. There's no question that a straight carbon tax or greenhouse gas tax would be simpler to administer. There are two questions. One is first, politically, it's simply not viable for exactly the same reasons. When John Boehner goes on the attack, that's something that every Democrat is worried about who wants to grapple with this problem. And the second point, which a lot of environmentalists make, is that As you know, again, Betsy pointed out, you have more of a certainty about what kind of greenhouse gas emissions reductions you're going to have with a cap and trade system, because you are putting an absolute limit on the amount of greenhouse gas emissions you could have in any given year. And with a tax, you have an expectation of what rising energy prices will do to consumer behavior or business behavior, but there's absolutely no guarantee that you will actually bring emissions in line with what people would want. And because passing a tax is so difficult, the idea of recalibrating it later on seems implausible in our political system.
So, Betsy, this bill, of which these are pieces of, will be intensely negotiated behind the scenes. I mean, what aspects of this may be watered down beyond cap and trade or that? But what should we keep an eye on as this process kicks into high gear?
Well, one of the big question marks, as I understand it, in the bill is, you know, where it says like dollars, you know, there's just a blank. So the question here is, and it's a big, big question, how are we apportioning these credits? Are we going to give them out? And this is what the big utility companies want. They say, if you make us pay for this, it's unfair. We started under one system where CO2 emissions were free. Now you're going to, you know, really clobber us. That's unfair. Now, other people would argue, and when Barack Obama's platform included what's called 100% auction, so you want a permit, you got to pay for it. And that really, when you think about it, makes a lot of sense. Because first of all, you know, you're collecting huge revenues, which, as Juliet says, you can then either give back to people or use for clean energy purposes. But the other point to make is, if your goal is to drive down carbon emissions, just grandfathering in, you know, industries that are huge carbon emitters is to a certain extent just locking in the status quo. So that is where the huge, you know, if you accept that we need to do something and you accept that it's a cap and trade, you know, all big ifs, then the real fight, and I think this is where the huge fight is going to be, is over how you apportion those credits. And the unfortunately, the system, the Europeans have a cap and trade, which they instituted, and it's getting better. I don't want to call it a complete failure, but initially...
But they have had problems with it.
Yes, because they gave out too many credits. They literally just gave out so many credits that it was worthless to sell or buy them. So there was very little change. The market didn't drive any innovation because I was a big emitter. I got so many credits, I didn't need to do anything. And so in that sense, it was initially a failure. But it has been fine-tuned, and it was a learning experience, so I don't want to I don't want to just totally write it off.
So, Juliet, does this all come down to cost here in the 30 seconds before our first break?
Certainly. I mean, I think that's a major factor, and, you know, but it's also, it is interesting because you do feel like people really are committed to trying to work something out, but there's a question of, do they cut so many deals that in the end, what they end up with is not a meaningful piece of legislation?
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Congress's first real look at capping carbon emissions and where the Obama administration will take green policies. Juliet Eilprin is with us. She's National Environment Reporter for The Washington Post. Betsy Colbert is here as well. She's staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes about climate change and the environment. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from Washington is Congressman Edward Markey, Democrat representing the 7th Congressional District of Massachusetts. He's chair of the Energy and Environment Subcommittee and co-author with Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Henry Waxman of the America Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. Congressional hearings for that bill begin today. Congressman Markey, nice to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
So I'd like to ask you about one aspect of the bill before we talk about the cost, which we referred to in our first segment. But your plan calls for a reduction of carbon emissions by 20% in 2020, 42% by 2030, and 83% by 2050. Is that a reasonable goal, and is it set in stone?
It is a reasonable goal. It is something that is equal to the magnitude of the challenge before us. But what it assumes is that we have improved dramatically the efficiency in the buildings that we build, the homes that we live in, that we've increased dramatically the fuel economy standards of the vehicles that we've driven by the year 2050, and that we're generating a very high percentage of our electricity from renewable electricity sources by 2050. All of these things are technologically possible. It won't be rocket science. It'll be auto mechanics and air conditioning mechanics and new building standards. But it's all achievable, and we have enough time to make this transition.
Well, as you well know, the key opposition to your climate change bill really comes from a lot of Democrats and manufacturing states from the interior of this country. And you and Congressman Waxman, Speaker Pelosi, the big champions of this bill, all come from the coasts. And I'm curious how you plan to entice your Democratic non-coastal colleagues to support this very complex and complicated bill.
Well, we are going to ensure that in the near term, we are going to give some carbon credits, that is to give protection to the steel industry, to the glass industry, to other trade-exposed, energy-intensive industries. But at the same time, if you're from steel country, for example, every single wind turbine that is built in the United States requires 250 to 400 tons of steel in order to construct them. The smart electricity grid that we're building is also steel and iron, and will require the communications workers to be part of it in order to build in the communications component. So we need to make this transition in order for us to create the new jobs for the 21st century, where America should be the leader. We don't believe that America needs to choose between a healthy manufacturing sector and a clean environment. You can have both. That's our opportunity to explain this as part of this discussion. And in the end, I think that the 3 to 5 million new jobs that we can create will be the blue-collar, green-collar jobs of the future.
That's one aspect of this. And as we talked about in the first segment, another big aspect is cost. And I'm curious about your draft bill as it relates to cap and trade, which we talked about in our first segment, whether there are allowances for the auctioning off or the giving away of the cap and trade issues to utilities and companies. That's such a big component of this as it relates to cost. Where do you stand on that as far as auctioning those permits and giving them away first rate?
Well, what we are going to do is to ensure that in the early years, again, as I already mentioned, that we are going to not auction off 100% of the carbon credits, but rather to ensure that the trade-exposed, energy-intensive industries will, in fact, receive some free allocations. That will ensure that the Chinese and other countries do not exploit the vulnerability of American industry in the early year. Our goal is to move as quickly as possible to 100% auction, but we also need to take care of consumers and American jobs during the time that we transition. So in the transition, we will support consumer protection measures and protect quality American jobs in steel, glass, paper, and other internationally competitive industries.
Congressman Markey, some people are saying in Washington that President Obama is becoming slightly more passive on this issue. Do you feel you have full White House support as you move forward with this bill?
I don't know where they gather any evidence of any lack of support by the president. On Friday, the Obama administration's EPA made a decision that is an historic game changer. The EPA, that is the Obama EPA, made a determination that CO2 is in fact a danger to the public health and well-being. And as a result, because of a Supreme Court mandate in April of 2007, the EPA now must take action to deal with that problem. And so it is no longer, in other words, a choice between legislation or nothing. It is now a choice between legislation or regulation by the Obama EPA. So I don't see any evidence that there is a lack of real interest in dealing with this problem inside of the Obama administration.
Well, Congressman Edward Markey from Massachusetts, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, sir, and good luck.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Congressman Markey is chair of the Energy and Environment Subcommittee and co-author of the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009. I'd like to go to the phones now to get some of our callers into this. Ron is up first. He's in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Ron. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me
on. You bet.
I listen quite intently to your program. It's very good, and I want to say thank you for showing all sides of this. One of the things that, you know, my economics background told me years ago that there has to be some sort of cost-benefit analysis applied to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm not, I'm always in favor of making sure we have clean air and clean water and we keep the environment as clean as possible, sometimes we're going to have to address this process of the extreme amount of cost associated with a possible benefit that we may not have a lot of chance to improve.
Mm.
So if you look at some of the statistics that are out there, they say that we're going to spend $4 trillion in America alone to bring up, to bring down the temperature one-tenth of a degree over the next 100 years. Some of those statistics have been batted around for years, and What I don't see a lot of is this cost-benefit analysis.
Well, let's talk about that. I appreciate the call. Thank you very much for that point. Juliette Eilprin, speak to that, the cost-benefit analysis. And really, in this economic recession, you know, when economic issues and environmental concerns clash, does the economy always win, especially now?
Right. Well, that's an unanswered question right now. I think we'll see what happens both in Congress and the administration. I think in terms of, you know, to address your caller's concerns, I'm not familiar with that estimate, which seems quite high, frankly, to say that it's going to cost that much money. You know, there are cost-benefit analyses that go on. The Environmental Protection Agency has actually been doing it. In fact, some of that work had been blocked by the Bush administration, applying a specific cost to carbon emissions. And so it is something that they're looking at under this new administration, and it kind of depends on which law you're looking at, whether you have an obligation to do a cost-benefit analysis. But I think part of this real question hinges on whether you're looking at long-term or short-term. Certainly, if you're looking at the immediate term, it's often cheaper to do what we're doing. The reason why we have coal-fired power plants is because they provide energy at a cheaper rate than other forms of energy at this point. However, when you look long term, there's certainly a slew of costs associated with climate change, and it's not just sea level rise, as we saw by the recent document issued by the EPA on Friday. There are public health costs that come that we're seeing already in terms of whether it's heat strokes that people suffer or transmission of airborne diseases. So it's actually a very complicated question. And I think the argument certainly that the Obama administration and people like Congressman Markey are trying to make to the American public is, in the long term, our economy is actually going to be better off being driven by clean energy than by fossil fuel energy. And whether they succeed in making that case before the American public remains to be seen.
Betsy and Juliette, hold on for just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation at this point. Joining me from Big Sur, California, is Bill McKibben. As an environmentalist and writer, he's been a leading voice in the environmental movement for the last two decades. His book, The End of Nature, published in 1989, was the first book for a general audience about climate change, and he's written many more since. Bill, glad to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be with you, Jane.
There's a big meeting on climate change in Copenhagen coming up in December, where the world will negotiate a successor to the Kyoto Treaty. Does President Obama need to show up in Copenhagen with some real credible U.S. legislation, and do you think that's possible?
Well, two questions. I mean, yes, he needs to show up with some commitment from the U.S. to finally do something. We're the biggest source of the biggest problem that human beings have ever faced, and if we're not willing to take some real leadership, then there's very little chance that the rest of the world will do the very hard things that they need to do to give us some hope of not preventing global warming but slowing it down some. Whether or not that's possible, we will learn in the next few days. I think it's worth underlining two things. One is that this really is a historic beginning. This 20 years ago this year that we really first started talking about global warming in public. And in those 20 years, the federal government has done absolutely nothing. There's been a unblemished bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing, and it's been entirely successful. And now we're finally, this week, trying for the first time to get the U.S. government to grapple with the single biggest issue we've ever faced. And, you know, it's just worth remembering the size of that issue. We're talking today about all the ins and outs of this particular legislation, but I'm looking out at the ocean as we talk. We've managed, as Betsy has written so powerfully, Betsy Colbert, we've managed in the last 10 years to reduce the pH of that ocean, that globe-swaddling ocean, from 8.2 to 8.1. I'm sitting today with in the California coast, a place ravaged by fire. Last year, one of the biggest fire seasons ever, fire becoming ever more prominent and dangerous around the world. We're on the precipice of real catastrophe, and you know we've got to get down to work, and it is going to be costly, and it is going to be difficult, and it is going to mean change, but we've got to make it happen.
I've got to go back to the phones now to Morrisville, Vermont. Hank is on the line. Hank, welcome to the program.
Yeah, welcome to you, too. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One thing, there's a couple issues I have to talk about. It's you know, a lot of people say that lowering the temperature 1 degree, you know, with this whole energy plan is not a big deal, but it is, because the population is going to double in a much faster rate than it doubled last time, from like, say, 60 years to probably about 20 years. And so that's a lot more people breathing, burning energy, needing home heating, and, you know, that's not being talked about.
Are you optimistic about the bill in Congress, Hank? Do you think something can actually be done about this?
I think the cap and trade is a good kind of a way, but I think you shouldn't be able to buy pollution credits if you're polluting. You know, so the ones that do clean up, they shouldn't be allowed to sell them, I think. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe a better tax credit would be better for them, because then that would be a more incentive to become cleaner. And, so if someone cleans up, someone's just going to be able to buy more and pollute more.
Well, that's one view, and I really appreciate you calling to tell us. Al is on the line now from Acton, Massachusetts. Al, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, well, go ahead.
You know, I listened to this discussion about carbon tax, and I'm reminded of what George Orwell said about if you can control language, you can control the political scene. And this should not be talked about as a carbon tax. What they're doing is they're foisting their pollution on the rest of us and asking us to pay for it, and then complaining when we ask them to pick up the tab themselves. If I were to take my garbage and drive down the highway and throw it out on the roadway for other people to pick up, I'd get pulled over by a police officer, and I'd be hauled into court, and I'd have to pay a fine. And no one would give me a lot of sympathy if I said, oh, how dare you tax me for throwing my garbage on the highway. That's what these companies have been doing, and they've been doing it for decades, and only now do we realize what the cost is that they're forcing the rest of us to bear. So I think if you use that kind of language, as the panel has been using most of this discussion, you're really starting with two strikes against you, and it's important to be accurate about what this is. We're trying to make them pay for the cost they're inflicting on everybody else.
Al, thanks. Betsy or Juliet, would you respond?
I think that's a good point that he makes, and I'd like an alternative. Someone propose an alternative, and we'll try to start using it.
I also think that, I mean, again, I think it's important in articles to refer to, for example, pollution credits and global warming pollution. I think there's no question, although it's interesting to note that with the EPA's recent endangerment finding that they've proposed, that's the first time that the federal government has ever declared carbon dioxide a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. So I think part of it is that, frankly, as your caller indicated, that there's a recognition of what greenhouse gases are doing now that, you know, is not the same thing that people understood 10 years ago. I also, however, believe in the accuracy of reporting. And the fact of the matter is you're putting a price on carbon. And I think you should be straightforward about that rather than obscure it.
Betsy Colbert, I have about 30 seconds before the break. You've written about this. Do you see public interest waning in the environment or not?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, if you look at the, you know, the polling data that we have, and I don't want to say it's totally accurate, the environment never gets up very high. It never raises its head, you know, sort of above middling concerns. So it's hard to be optimistic that people are paying enough attention to this issue at this critical moment.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, one day before the nation celebrates Earth Day, we are taking stock of this green moment and how the public and lawmakers are thinking about the environment and environmental policies. We've got a terrific panel with us today. Juliet Eilprin is a national environment reporter for The Washington Post, and Betsy Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, and Bill McKibben's with us. He's a top environmental author and activist. Let's get some more listeners into the conversation, to the mix here. Ted is first up in Boston. Hi, Ted. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, great to be on the show. I just wanted to make a point. You know, I think we are at the stage where we have to take action. It's not about whether we can do this or cannot do this. The consequences of not taking action on climate change are huge. And one of the exciting things that I've seen, and maybe your guests know about this, is a group called Ceres has put together an organization by the name of BICEP, BICEP, and it's basically, you know, it's companies like Starbucks and Nike and Sun Microsystems and Gap and others who are all pushing for really, really good legislation and trying to show that there are risks and opportunities, and this is the way forward for the country and for companies to get us out of, you know, to create jobs and get us out of the hole that we're in, both economically and environmentally.
Ted, thank you. Bill McKibben, what do you see in this corporate push that Ted speaks of, companies getting together to actually create some change?
What we see is the kind of battle between the economy of the future and the economy of the past. The foes to doing something about climate aren't all businesses. They're heavily concentrated in the fossil fuel industry and a couple of other very energy-intensive sectors that don't want to pay more, whose business model is based on the fact that they're allowed to spew carbon into the atmosphere for free. And so it's going to be that's one of the things to watch. Unfortunately, of course, in our political system, those who've built up economic power in the past are able to use it to influence the future. That is, the coal industry is clearly not the future, but they've got so much money that they can maybe able to delay for a while the kind of laws that would make wind and solar and things competitive. The missing part of this, however, and the reason that this is so problematic, the reason that it's so difficult to get something good out of Congress when it's faced with this huge crisis, is that there hasn't been a real broad-based movement among citizens to demand action. Mm. That's what we started building a couple of years ago in this country with a thing called Step It Up, where we had 1,400 rallies around the country in all 50 states that really changed Barack Obama's energy position. Now we're trying to do the same thing globally with a group called 350.org, 350.org. We have a bottom line now for this crisis that we're facing. It's not mysterious. Our best scientists have told us that if there's more than 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, that the planet can't operate correctly, at least as far as humans are concerned. And since we're past that number, it means that we're in a crisis. And the bottom line really is that we continue to treat this as a negotiation, a bargain between different interest groups, different economic players, whatever. The real bargaining right now is going on between human beings and physics and chemistry. And physics and chemistry don't really want to bargain, you know?
You know, it's an interesting point that you bring up, Bill. And Juliet Alperin, I'd like you to touch on it, because we've talked about the political headwinds, but there are also headwinds from environmentalists themselves, with talk of, you know, I'm reading, I think it was in your writing, where, you know, there's discussion of piping solar power from New Mexico into Arizona, and environmentalists didn't like that, may hurt wildlife. You know, corn ethanol, which is being touted as the new biofuel, actually contributes more, not less, in greenhouse gases. So there's a push, there's a real conflict here on both fronts. Is there not, Juliet?
Certainly. And I think, you know, obviously what people are talking about here is a massive transformation of our nation's energy system. And when you talk about doing it, there are a whole slew of consequences. And so, you know, again, right, what I was writing about just last week is this idea that while there's an enormous support for renewable energy, and that's something that the Obama administration is moving aggressively on, even without congressional action, you also have to take into account what's the habitat destruction that comes with that, how many of the areas that are most promising in terms of renewable energy also have vulnerable species that have to be taken into account. And again, it's not that these are irreconcilable differences, but I think it speaks to the complexity of the task that policymakers face when they're trying to get serious about this issue.
Here's another call now from Charleston, South Carolina. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. Welcome.
Hi, John. Jane. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I had a question more than a statement, simply because I really don't know very much about what we're discussing here. But if no action is taken at all, if we continue doing things the way we've been doing them, how much financially can we expect to lose in terms of like agriculture and lumber and the fishing industry?
Practically speaking. Paula here at Betsy Colbert, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? And I think that gets to this cost-benefit analysis and how difficult it is to do. I mean, if you just keep on what is often called a business-as-usual trajectory, then we reach, you know, extremely high CO2 levels, not very long from now, by the middle of the century. And when all is said and done, so when that heat sort of works its way through the system. It takes a couple of decades to be fully realized. You know, many people are talking about, you know, absolute collapse of ecosystems. So you really get very, very dire consequences. And people have made the point that economic typical cost-benefit analyses are just not adequate to this job. If you have the possibility, you know, of, I don't want to say zero standard of living, but, you know, real global ecological catastrophe, how do you really factor that in dollars and cents? So I don't know that anyone has done, but the Stern report, I suppose, came closest to that. And they said that, you know, you could be looking at, I think it was a 20% loss of global GDP if we just kept on as we were going by the end of this century. So, you know, you're looking at massive losses in agriculture. You're looking at having to move the major cities in the world back from the coast. We're not talking about, you know, small inconvenient changes here.
Here's another call from David. He's in Stamford, Connecticut. Welcome, David.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I was trying to say that what bothers me is the way they coach things to make it sound like, oh, energy is going to get a lot more expensive if we do this carbon cap and trade, whereas the reality is, we're running out of electricity in this country, and it's going to get more expensive one way or another, whether you build a lot more, you know, dirty coal-fired power plants or nuclear power or whatever. It's going to get more expensive, and we also have to upgrade the national grid as well. So, you know, there's several ways you can go about doing it, but it's definitely going to get more expensive. And also, another point is that these large industries like coal and nuclear, they're already heavily subsidized, so we're already paying for a lot more for our energy than we're even aware of.
Mm.
So when these things get all factored in, you know, doing a carbon cap and trade, which would promote more renewable energy, would be more cost effective.
David, thank you. Juliet Eilprin, would you respond to that?
I actually have to, just on a factual basis, take issue with that caller. You know, we're not running out of electricity. One of the problems we have is that the U.S. has been called the Saudi Arabia of coal, and we actually, you know, have a couple hundred years left of a coal supply. Now, again, I totally agree that it depends on how you do the cost-benefit analysis. When people look at, you know, how much coal we're using, they don't often factor into, say, the cost of the environmental destruction that happens in areas like West Virginia and Kentucky when we're doing mountaintop mining. And so, again, you can argue about whether I think that there's certainly a strong argument that, for example, people in fossil fuel dependent states who get their electricity primarily from coal, Indiana, other states, Ohio, they aren't certainly paying the true price of their electricity, but frankly, one of the reasons why people use a polluting substance such as coal is because it's relatively cheap to obtain.
Mm. Here's another call from Burlington, Vermont. Solveig is on the line. Solveig, thank you for waiting. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Jane. I just wanted to give a shout-out to Bill McKibben from Vermont. I was just at a panel with Bob Costanza speaking about ecological economics. And, you know, with all this talk about cost-benefit analyses of, is it worth it to go green or is it going to cost too much money? It's like, well, already we're in a situation where we're not fully accounting for all the costs of the current way of doing business. And this is a great opportunity for us to move away from growth economics, which presupposes that everything has to get more and more incrementally year after year, and that's just not realistic in a finite planet. So ecological economics, which counts capital not just as money and stuff that we build, but also, you know, forests and people's education and community and stuff like that, I think is a really great tool for us to move towards a more full accounting of the way we do business.
Thank you so much, Solveig. I'll let you respond, Bill McKibben.
Well, she's completely right. And it's, you know, Betsy referred a second ago to the Stern report. Just to give people a sense of what we're talking about, this is Nicholas Stern, the British economist, asked by the British government to assess the costs of global warming. And he said that the short-run costs would be on a scale of World War I, World War II, and the Great Depression combined, okay? We're talking about a meltdown that far exceeds even the financial meltdown in terms of its economic impact. But its economic impact, in a sense, is the least of it. I mean, everybody's got to wake up. The Arctic melted two summers ago, the last two summers. We had 25% less sea ice than we'd ever seen before. Tundra and the permafrost beneath it are melting fast, and methane, another potent greenhouse gas, starting to escape into the atmosphere. This is not a question of some, you know, of two costly things and what should we do. This is a question about survival, and building the building the political momentum necessary to defeat the old ways of doing business is got to be job one. And people who really want to do that, who want to do more than talk about it, please join us at 350.org and try to build what's a really powerful and interesting global coalition on the grassroots of people standing up to say, this is the future that we're talking about, and we're not going to let it be taken away simply because it's costly to some key industries.
Juliet Eilprin, I'm curious how the stimulus bill and money in the stimulus bill is going to be spent in terms of green projects. And what's the view of the energy and environmental communities on a potential influx of cash?
Well, they're very supportive of the stimulus bill, which has, by some estimates, as much as certainly between $80 and $100 billion for projects that are considered green. It, in fact, is the most massive energy bill that we've had, period, in years. And so even surpassing the bill that was passed at the end of 2007 in many ways. So, you know, there's no question that there's tons of money in that for a range of environmental issues. Certainly including issues like climate and research and as well as energy projects, the habitat restoration. And so there's just no question that there's a lot of money in there that certainly can help start this transition. And it's something that administration officials, you know, point to. But I think, as obviously members of the panel have indicated, that's not the same thing as establishing an overall cap for emissions and sending a price signal for greenhouse gas gases in a way that we haven't had before.
That's really the heart of it. Let's get another couple of calls in here. Nick is now on the line from Norwich, Connecticut. Hi, Nick. Welcome. Not much time, if you could be brief, sir.
Hi. I've just got a couple of points. The
sure.
First is that essentially all of the people who can be won on the environmental argument have been won. In order to push this thing over the top, we must seek other groups. And there are two ready-made groups sitting there waiting to vote for this. And frankly, they're bigger. The first is that the country is sick and tired of sending $1 billion a day, which could be argued as the reason why the economy is broken. We've got to stop buying oil from other people. And number two, as long as we have that kind of insatiable demand for oil, those around the world who would do us harm will keep us at war forever. So those two arguments need to be put forward. The environmental argument, okay, you've won me, you've won 20% of the population, but it's not going to grow. You must bring in these other groups. And if you do and make those arguments successfully, the game is over. We will have environmentally safe energy within 10 years, and this country will be off oil.
Mm. Nick, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to circle back to where we started this hour with the American Clean Energy and Security Act of 2009 and get all of your perspectives about how do you think this bill, do you think it will eventually pass or some version of it? Are you optimistic? Juliet, I'll bring you first.
I think that this bill stands a strong chance of passing both through first as to go through subcommittee will actually be a considerable challenge, but then the full committee in the House. I think the real question comes down to the Senate, where certainly the leaders right now say they don't have the votes to pass a similar piece of legislation. And I think the real question is what kind of compromise can they fashion through the House process, and will that give it sufficient momentum to win over swing Democrats as well as some Republicans in the Senate.
Mm. And what do you think, Betsy? Do you agree or perhaps a watered-down version of what might be?
Well, I think that the prospect of a watered-down bill is a very real one and a very scary one. And I think that Bill's point really can't be stressed in his work, can't be lauded more. We need, you know, you have very powerful interests. They've made no secret that they plan to try to kill this any kind of legislation. And what is the, in a democracy, what is the only thing we've got going for us? It's the voters. And the voters have, you know, unfortunately, by and large, sat on the sidelines. And, you know, if there was a time now where we needed, you know, the power to the people, we need it now. And we need people to really make their voices heard. That's the only countervailing political pressure here. And we need it.
Bill McKibben, I'll give you the last word here in our last minute.
ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay. That buys an awful lot of influence. Everybody who understands the depth of the crisis that we're in could pool their pocket change and come up well short of Exxon's $40 billion profit. We're not going to win that way. We are going to win if we're able to mobilize people into a real movement that holds people accountable for the future. That's what we're trying to do at 350.org. It becomes more key every day because this is the historic year. We either get it right now or we risk not getting it right ever.
Bill McKibben, top environmental author and activist. Bill, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Betsy Colbert is staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Betsy, much thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Juliet Eilprin, a national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Juliet, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook as well at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.